Hello and welcome to this latest session of You Matter. Hello and welcome to You Matter. This time I'm talking to ex-physiotherapist and experienced coach Lisa Wynn. And we are discussing the subject of when coaching isn't the right thing, which might sound a bit of a strange subject, but bear with us. It proved to be a really good backdrop for a conversation around many aspects of coaching and physio and where they intersect. So it doesn't matter if you're a physio or any other type of clinician, you're going to see lots of parallels between coaching and your profession, lots of aha moments. I think there certainly were loads for me. So sit back, enjoy the conversation, and I will see you at the end. Hello and welcome to this latest episode of You Matter, and I'm thrilled to have Lisa Wynn with me here as my guest today. So Lisa is a coaching friend and an ex-physio. Joyously, she's somebody I discovered through coaching and then very quickly discovered that Lisa was a physio. And there's not many of us about, so that was a nice find. So Lisa transitioned into coaching, which you won't mind me saying, I don't think, quite some time ago. Stats-wise, I said to Lisa just now, have you got any stats about how much coaching you've done, how many people you've coached? And she gave me the lovely line that she stopped counting at 10,000 hours of coaching, and that was 10 years ago. So I think we can basically say that Lisa is a pretty well-qualified coach. Lisa, would you like to add anything more about your physio years, perhaps a little bit about what made you make that switch from physio into coaching? Anything else you want to add to that intro?
I mean, I would say that I absolutely adored every minute of my life as a physiotherapist, and it was an accident that I changed. I found coaching to help me become a better physiotherapist,
right?
Because I was struggling with how do you get people to take, you know, when people believe you, they trust in you, give them great advice, and then they come back next week with an excuse, and you think I didn't understand. So I started, you know, researching that, came across coaching, trained as a coach, and then sort of made the transition. So it was only ever supposed to make me a better physio.
And did you ever use your coaching, did you ever take it back to physio and see if that sort of thought had worked, that coaching would improve that compliance with exercises or advice?
Yeah, definitely. I started to. I didn't stay a lot longer in physio, because what I found is I was then running two businesses that both needed more than half my time. More than half my energy and spirit and all the things. But yeah, definitely taking it back, taking longer with assessments, understanding more about the sort of underlying emotions and mentality of the patient, and then being different in terms of how I shared my feedback and advice at the end. So definitely. And also I'd say I've brought my physio learning into my coaching.
Right. Which bits would you say supported your coaching?
So much, because one, just having the experience of knowing that change isn't as easy as we like to think. Of recognizing that even when somebody's job is on the line or their professional sport is on the line. I worked with first class footballers for a while. And even when it matters so much that we get rid of our pain, that people still don't change. That knowledge was really powerful, because I brought that inquiry into my coaching. I'm a lot more empathy and compassion when people didn't do what they said they were going to do, and a lot more curiosity about that. But also the whole sort of somatic side and understanding that so much change happens in the body. I remember going to my first coach training program, and they were all sat in sort of groups of three talking to each other in the practice session, sitting very still. And I remember thinking, how why do these people think that change is so cognitive? How do they not recognize that the power of tapping into your nervous system and your physicality in order to make change? So I've always been much more physical with my coaching. And these days, neuroscience and somatics and embodiment, it's all sort of coming into coaching. Whereas I've sort of brought it in 22 years ago when I started coaching.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense with the two worlds. And I don't know how much you followed physio since you left, but I think you'd be encouraged by the introduction of things like motivational interviewing and change management. But it's still that still feels quite early days, and I think there are still evolutions to go within physiotherapy. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about that the other way around, of bringing that physical side of physio into coaching. Completely agree with you. I'm just reminded of doing a trainer's course last year, where quite rightly one of the first bits of training we were given, the training tools, was to stop moving, just to talk and deliver material, educational material, with our arms by our sides. And I found that so difficult. And it was sensible because the idea was then that we would bring back intentional movements. But that was really instructive to me to realize that I talk and I move at the same time, and I teach well when I can move, and the same thing for clients when they can move as well. And it's interesting, isn't it? I wonder how you found, because I know you've gone very much from on stage coaching all over the world to an online business, which involves much less movement on both sides. Is that something you've been aware of as you've shifted online?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I did my first 1,000 hours of coaching on the telephone. I'm not talking internet or Zoom. I'm talking telephone. That's how old I am. I think I had this sort of really intense training at the beginning where listening was such a visceral experience because you weren't face to face. Sometimes what I really found is that people can distract you almost face to face. If I'm showing up for you as my coach and I want to pretend that I'm better than I am, I physically come in and lean into it, right? But if you can't see me, I don't think to do that. So it's fascinating that you can hear people sinking into themselves on the phone. And I remember saying to people, like, just sit up a minute. Like, how do you know? How do you know I wasn't sitting up? Because you can hear that. And as a physiotherapist, you're so conscious of movement. And then I got into this space where, I was on stages on around the world and doing face-to-face coaching. And then suddenly coming back to both coaching and training, sitting in front of Zoom. It's not my favorite, but I've learned to love it because otherwise I wouldn't be doing it, quite frankly, right now. But that whole difference of being still but being able to see somebody, that was a whole new evolution for me that I had to really learn how to do that.
Yeah, that is interesting on the telephone bit, though, that you maybe because of being a physio, I'm sure because of being a physio, you could hear the movement. So it isn't necessarily something you see or mirror, or have to get visual feedback on. You can put together all the things that you're picking up with your senses and decipher movement. It's really interesting. Okay, so let's get to the subject of this episode, which is based around strange title, When Coaching Isn't Right, which seems an odd title, but hopefully we'll wind our way around and it will make sense by the end. So a coaching client recently said to me, she's done quite a lot of coaching with me, and we've had lots of conversation about coaching, and she said, "Oh, Jo, I was just thoughtful about when perhaps coaching doesn't work so well." And then she went on to ask three questions. She said, "Are there any prerequisites for coaching to be successful? If they're not there, can you teach them? And what are the coaching failures?" Those were her words. So I've got my thoughts on those things, but Lisa, can I take them one at a time and start with you? So, prerequisites for successful coaching. What are your thoughts on that?
In the coach or the coachee or both?
Good question. She didn't state that.
So, in the coaching, I mean, openness is the most important thing. An openness to explore yourself, to think differently. You know, if somebody's coming to coaching to prove themselves right, then you're not going anywhere, really. Almost certainly not. Yeah, sometimes I've certainly coached a lot of people who, when you start, they're there to prove themselves right. But if they hold on to it, then you're stuck. Coaching's not gonna work, really. If the coachee is afraid to be vulnerable, you know, if they're really afraid to lean into not just their sort of shadows, but also their aspirations. So if somebody's been told so many times that whenever you say you want to achieve something, people, you know, if I've said as a child I want to be an astronaut, and people have said, girls aren't astronauts, then I might have learned to stop sharing my aspirations. So that willingness to be vulnerable, willingness to be in partnership, is, I would say, needs to happen. If they really want to lead every conversation and only talk about the things they're comfortable with, coaching is going to be very limited. And finally, I would say, I mean, I think there's loads of answers, but finally, I would say, if they're not emotionally well enough, because coaching assumes that somebody is whole and resourceful, that they are m mentally, emotionally, and spiritually well enough to change and ready to do so. And if they're not, then it's much more important that they get some healing, some therapy, something else in order to be ready for coaching.
Maybe what you've just said answers a question I was going to jump in with, but I think it probably answers it in part. So I was going to say, in response to your first points about someone needing to be open or being comfortable with being open and being vulnerable, what would you say are the prerequisites for someone to be open, to being open and vulnerable?
Well, I suppose partly it goes hand in hand with the well enough. That if somebody doesn't feel safe, if they haven't been treated well, then that's very difficult. Some people just don't know how to do it. And that's always really interesting, because I see so many people labeled as uncoachable, which is not a word I use and not a word that I enjoy in the coaching profession. Because it being coachable is so much, it's such a two-way street. So I might not be coachable by one person, but I am by somebody else. So there's this interplay between coach and coachee, which creates the openness.
And what I hear in that is trust. And when I was thinking about those prerequisites, I definitely had the same ideas as you around openness. But I also thought, do I need that on day one? Or do I just need enough signals and confidence that that openness and that comfort with vulnerability can come with time, provided we can create the right level of trust between us as coach and coachee?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because for me, trust is a field, it's not a destination. So I can see the potential for trust and trust enough to want to move towards it. you know, that's like, if you like, that's introductory levels of trust.
Yeah.
But for the coach might feel that, but for the coachee, if they found, if their trust has been betrayed many times, if they're feeling really scared, then it's a huge step to be trusting enough to see if we can move towards trust.
Yeah.
You know, so really recognizing wherever the coachee is, that is huge openness. What looks like one person's little bit of openness might be somebody else's vast chasm of openness.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's almost a sublayer to your prerequisite of openness. It's enough openness to make the shift that the client needs, the coachee needs at that moment.
Yeah, because, you know, so many coaches talk about intimacy. So intimacy is a word that has been removed from the core coaching competencies in the recent update,
right?
Which makes so much sense, because in so many languages it's misunderstood in translation. And sounds like a different type of relationship.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So it's being moved to create safety rather than create intimacy.
Right.
But the thing that was always so important to me about that intimacy was coaches always wanted the coachee to feel like they could be intimate with the coach.
Right.
In an openness way, right? We can see why we need to change the language. But the importance is, for me, has always been that I create, as a coach, I create a space where the coachee can be intimate with themselves.
Okay.
So when as the coach is creating so much safety, and then the safety is an invitation, and then the coachee gets to step into it in whatever levels it likes. A lot of coaches come to me and they already trust me, probably more than they should from my reputation. And they'll come and they'll say, coaching has never worked for me before, but I know you're the one. And there's sometimes a sort of almost talking them back a little bit, saying, yeah, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, but you know, this is about you. You know, I'm creating the space. There's a huge level of trust. So you're bringing that into the coaching and I trust you. It's giving them back the power. That just because they trust me doesn't make me the most powerful part of the conversation. They still should be the most powerful part of the conversation.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And with coaching becoming so much more something that people are increasingly more aware of, but maybe not with always great explanations to what coaching is, I think there is a danger, even if you don't know the coach that you're going towards, just that you have this idea of a coach. And, you know, they're a coach, so of course they're going to be someone I can trust, because, you know, that's what in my mind this coaching container is. So I'm going to jump in with both feet. Yeah, and I hear that responsibility as a coach to manage that. The coachee is where they're at and with their beliefs around coaching. Yeah, that's definitely a deeper layer than I had considered in that question. I think we've sort of touched on, are these things teachable? My response almost to that would be, should we want to teach them? If we're agreeing that openness and willingness to be vulnerable are important prerequisites, are they things we can or want to teach if they're not there?
Well, interestingly, teaching is not really a part of coaching.
No.
So I just think it's worth, because we're in this subject of when not to coach. And so that fits a lot within the code of ethics, for instance, in coaching. I just think it's really worth recognizing that if we're going into a coaching relationship and the biggest part of what we need to do at the beginning is teach, then that's when coaching probably shouldn't happen. Having said that, I don't really think it's about teaching. I think it's about honoring wherever that person is. So if somebody's coming to me and saying, I really want to work on myself, you're not allowed to talk about my marriage, you're not allowed to talk about my career, you're not allowed to talk about these things, only going to talk about this little thing here, then that's where they are. And as a coach, if we're prepared to meet somebody where they are, we sort of loosen that person's grip potentially on the control they feel they need.
Right.
So this is where active listening is so important, because the quality of the sort of nature of but in which somebody speaks is more important than the words they use. Imagine, like, you know, if you say, I don't know, it's Christmas and your mother-in-law's there with the sherry in her hand, and she says, oh, no more, thank you, and her hand's like hovering, and you say, you sure? Oh, go on then, just a little bit, and you put a little bit, and she goes, sure? A bit more. Yeah, whereas that's different from somebody, no more, thank you very much. So as a physiotherapist, this is what's so beautiful, is that we've really had all those years of training of hearing where somebody's a bit nervous about something that they want to step into. Or are they saying, no, don't touch, hands off?
Yeah.
So we bring that incredible sense of knowing what people mean by what they say often, or not necessarily knowing, but sensing and having the humility to ask.
Yes, to check in.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, so we can create, rather than teach these things, we create a space where they could happen. As soon as we're pushing, you know, if you go into a joint, if you're doing a manipulation or something, you go into a joint, if you were to go right to the hard end point and everything spasms and they're like, get away, it's that, right? But if you ease into a joint and you feel where the tension starts, and then you just feel for how far is the sort of therapeutic point where you can stay, that's exactly, I always remember that from my sort of manipulation training days and things, and thinking, that's exactly my experience when I'm listening. What's the point at which, if I go a bit too far, it's too far? But if I come back a bit, it's ineffective.
That's sweet spot.
Mm.
Yeah. And there'll be lots of physios and other clinicians who use their hands listening to this. And that would make a huge amount of sense of that. Not sort of teasing and enticing and persuading, but as you say, with your hands feeling, but with your active listening, also feeling for that sweet spot that, as you say, is not too much and not too little to be effective. That's a really nice analogy. I remember that one definitely as a physio.
I remember my first day, I trained at Guy's Hospital, and our massage teacher was about 150. bless her. And she, and I remember that we all were told, like, take your tops off. So we all sort of stood like this, and then she said, right, put your hands on, and we all started tickling each other effectively because we were scared to put our hands on. And I remember her sort of coming up, and she had these tiny little hands, and she put them on so firmly that I just felt myself relax. And then some people were there with their bony fingers digging in, and you couldn't wait for it to stop, you know. But I just remember her saying, let's do this in a business-like way. That confident approach, which is really sensing the other person and adjusting moment to moment, is so powerful when you take the sort of somatic experience of that and you bring it into your listening.
Yeah, and in physio or coaching, that's exactly the safety creation that you're talking about, isn't it? I remember exactly the same experience. Maybe all massage therapists had lovely big hands as well. They just seemed like you just knew, even though your face was down on the bed, you knew when your teacher had just come and taken over. Okay, so do you have many occasions, Lisa, where you have a sense that you probably wouldn't talk internally in terms of prerequisites, but how often do you have the sense that no, there's just enough not feeling right here that I'm going to call it, that coaching isn't right at this moment?
Very rarely.
Okay.
Certainly at the beginning. But then I think, you know, that background in healthcare, I know the difference between restorative coaching and, you know, change the world coaching. So for some people, when they first come to coaching, they're they're ready to make what feel to me like baby steps, but I know for them are huge things. So because I have that immense respect for human nature, and I know how to take my ego out of the equation, if I'm so focused on them doing a great job, them transforming, that's about me, and I'm going to miss that. So sometimes at the beginning, when somebody comes for coaching, and there's a feeling of, are they ready to change? What I found is when I ask people, they'll say yes. And if I'm not 100% sure, then I would build into the contracting that if at any point it feels like we're not moving forward, I'll have that conversation with them, and I'll just check in and see whether this is going well for you, how it's going. So I would say most people who first come to coaching are ready. You know, my marketing is laid up for that. People have got to know me. They've heard about coaching. And this is one of the big gifts, actually, of having the face-to-face business wiped out overnight by the pandemic. Because now everyone who comes to me for coaching has followed me on social media, or heard me talk, or, you know, they've got some idea about what coaching is. When I started, nobody knew what coaching was. So a lot of people were coming for coaching who were scared to go to therapy, or who had a stigma about therapy. We don't have that anymore, you know, in the same way. I'm not saying it's gone, but so it's very, very unusual that somebody comes to coaching and emotionally they're not well enough for it. More in the corporate world, when I'm doing corporate coaching, interestingly, because then people are under some obligation to come for coaching, or they, organizationally, imagine that somebody wants to change, but nobody in their team, nobody in their environment will allow them to change. Sometimes that makes it harder. That's more likely.
Right. So lack of readiness may not actually be much to do with the coachee, but the environment that they're in. Would you mind, Lisa, talking a little bit? I know you said it has improved, but that thing you just said about coming to coaching because maybe they're scared, or there's a stigma around counselling or therapy. What was your, because you've experienced that and hopefully an improvement, would you mind talking about it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started coaching sort of 22 years ago, there was, I think I'm right in saying that there was less, almost less professionalism, less, I don't want to use the word control, but that's, you know, regulation is the word I'm looking for. There was less regulation around coaching, around therapy. But it used to be something that you only had if you were broken or you were weak, or, you know, and coaching did get some of that sort of remedial sense at the beginning. But nowadays, I think it's generally much more acceptable that when you're not emotionally well enough to move forwards, you go to a therapist.
Yeah.
And the therapist helps you heal. It's not like you're somehow less than, you just need healing. And I think there's more acceptance that sometimes you need healing. There's more acceptance that life is a bit traumatic. I mean, I trust life intensely. I'm an enormously positive person, but so many things in life cause trauma. And sometimes it's the day-by-day trauma rather than some big incident, like working for a boss every day who puts you down, for instance. So there's so much more acceptance in my experience these days that you heal to get ready for today, and then from today you move forward into creating a different future. And they're two different processes. Sometimes they cross over. I'm not saying they don't, but, you know, if somebody's really stuck in that emotional past, then coaching actually becomes unethical.
Yeah. And you mentioned the term restorative coaching a moment ago. Is that where possibly that crossover might occur between healing and coaching?
So for me, restorative coaching is something that is the term I sort of came up with a long time ago and I've written about a lot. I don't think it's something which you'll hear a lot about. But for me, restorative coaching is for that person who is getting through the day, but is not so stuck in the past, has done enough healing in the past, but it's just gathering your strength, you know, it's gathering enough self-esteem, it's gathering enough energy, and those apparent small steps, like self-care at that point, meeting your needs, setting boundaries, those things actually gather up your energy, like reintegrate your energy that's been so dispersed. And it's often like quite a snowball effect. But it takes a very experienced coach, and I think it also takes a very loving coach, coach who loves people much, much more than results.
Yeah, that totally speaks to what you said about the sometimes the coach needing the transformative version when it's not the right time. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go to the third part or the third question in that trio, which was, what are the failures in coaching? Mm-hmm. Are there failures in coaching?
Of course. I mean, I suppose it depends how you define failures. You know, the failures, failure is sort of the F word in coaching, isn't mm-hmm. it? So sometimes people just aren't ready, you know, and one of the things I found is when somebody's not moving forward, that's one of the sort of techniques. It's one of the things we need to know as coaches, to recognize that and to feed that in a neutral, non-judgmental way back to the coachee. Mm. And sometimes that person will say, you know what, I would start with an open question in terms of how much we're moving forward. And they're like, I feel like we're really moving forward. And I might need to challenge that and say, so how are we moving forward? And then when you really know we're not moving forward, and then you say, you know, this might not be the time for you. Sometimes they'll say, no, you know what? This has really given me the kick I needed. I'm going to make this work. And sometimes they say, is that okay? You know, I've given a lot of people permission that they don't have to change right now if they're not ready.
Mm.
And then sometimes people walk away from coaching very grateful. I don't think that's a failure. I think it's just a recognition that now wasn't the right time.
Mm.
And then, you know, they'll go away with some consciousness about how to get to the right time.
Yeah. And goodness, again, how many times have we had to have that conversation as physios? I was, you know, hoping that we might see this, or maybe you were hoping we might see this. What do you think? Are we there? Do you have any thoughts about whether you want to do things differently, or, you know, is this the end point of our relationship? And I can remember countless versions of that conversation as a physio. Perhaps I shouldn't admit that, but
you know, it's the thing is, it always takes two.
Mm.
I mean, I worked in the NHS when the patient's charter was new. And people would phone us up and say, I know my rights, you've got to make me better. You know, it's like, it's not going to, I don't think we were even covered by the patient's charter. But, you know, if somebody doesn't want to take responsibility for their part, then there's not really anything that we can do to some extent. And another, like, coach, physio, and probably forgive me, everyone listening, because I'm a dinosaur. I haven't worked as a physio since 2003. So in the olden days, we used to talk about carryover from treatment, like therapeutic carryovers. That's still yes. So and I think that's also interesting that, you know, some patients are really happy if they feel a bit better at the end of a treatment, but then they come back next for the next appointment and they've gone back to where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is often true of coaching, where people, you know, talk to you for an hour, feel so much better, come back next time, they haven't moved forward. You know, there's no carryover.
Mm.
So if somebody's not actually moving forward, then the danger is that we're creating a dependency.
Yeah.
Where, and you know, the same thing happens with some patients, right? That they want to come for their weekly chat, they, you know, the socialize, whatever it is.
Mm.
And it's a beautiful thing, it's a wonderful thing, but it's not having a therapeutic impact in the longer run. In the way that you're designed to work as a musculoskeletal professional.
Mm. Isn't it funny how many of the words are just exactly relevant to both carryover and dependency? Absolutely, in coaching and physio. Yeah. At the start, you asked a very good question. Did the prerequisites refer to the coach or the coachee? And we didn't cover too much about what the prerequisites for a coach might be. So what might, if perhaps people are listening and, you know, hearing all these analogies between physio and coaching, thinking, well, you know, sounds like something that I could maybe move into or add to my skills. So are there prerequisites to be a good coach?
Definitely. And again, I think there's a lot of crossover with being a great musculoskeletal therapist of any kind. You've got to love people. And that's the most important thing. You have to love people. Mm. But you definitely have to trust people as well. You know, in terms of trust them to make change, trust that they can make change. If you're somebody who loves people, but it's not this, it's this sort of overly motherly,
mm.
you know, that you, if you sometimes, you know, I've mentored young physios, like younger than newer than me physios who couldn't let go of patients, you know, they wanted to keep them forever. It's that you have to be able to trust that people can do the work and that they can do it with or without you. You know, so I think being able to see people's strengths, and you need to be able to take your ego out of it, because some people won't change. Some people will change so significantly that you think, well, that's more significant than our coaching was. You know, and I can see coaches sometimes that almost want to limit somebody to change in the amount that they, in the way they want them to change.
Mm.
And you need that, you need to be able to create, you need to be a safe human.
That's a great point.
One of my favorite expressions, really. You have to be a safe human. You have to be able to hold people's emotions and not get swept away in them and not need to fix them. You know, to be able to sit and look at somebody's shadows without needing to fix them and without being scared of them.
You have another lovely phrase. I love safe human. I'm definitely going to log that one. But I've had some teaching with you, Lisa, and I always remember something you said. You weren't talking to me, actually. You were talking to somebody else on a call, and you suggested not to have too much reverence for emotion. On the face of it, out of context, that sounds a bit odd. And I was... straight away then when you said it, I thought back to being a physio. Okay, it's a bit like not having too much reverence for pain, which sounds awful because it sounds like you're just gonna not care that the patient's in pain. But I know from the context of that conversation that you meant don't have so much reverence that you want to back both of you out of that conversation as quickly as possible, and you want to save that person from that feeling in that moment. Which, you know, if someone is stuck in trauma and going deep into a story, yes, that's an element of safety. But I know what you meant in that moment was stay there long enough to allow the change that can happen in that moment to happen, rather than getting scared and backing off too quickly. I think that's what you meant. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Totally. You know, sadness is so transformative. Most of the world's greatest works of art come from sadness.
Mm.
When you think about it, sort of anger can be so transformative if you allow the anger to move through and then see what's behind it. Mm. When I remember as a physio being taught the acronym SIN. Do you still use that? Severity, irritability, and nature.
Yes, I do. I don't use it so much now, but yes, it was definitely in my toolkit.
I remember, and I again, that's another one that I often think of, like if somebody's emotions are so severe that they can't carry on, that's an indicator, isn't it? And if their emotions are so easily irritated, like the minute you start to talk, they're in a fluster, or if the nature worries you. You know, if somebody gets deeply distressed constantly rather than emotive, and this is why I really think physios are so well placed to move to bring coaching into their practice, because we're trained to we I'm putting myself back in those shoes, like once a physio, always a physio. CSP would argue at this point.
Maybe the
But that ability to feel the end point, to feel the nature of movement, to see the whole person, to know that, you know, the nervous system, the ligaments, everything is working together, and to love people and know that however good you are at what you do, you're limited by how much the other person wants to help themselves. All of these things are beautifully true of physio and coaching.
And do you think maybe it's too detailed of a point, but do you think there are prerequisites within the person, coach or physio, that make that ability to be the safe human more possible, or is it experience?
I think there are some things that's hard, you know, that you don't get the experience without having first. You know, if you don't love humans, you're not going to have the right quality of experience as a coach to get better at it. You know, I've worked with physios who don't seem to like people very much, and I've been asked to train coaches, particularly in the corporate arena where people are sent rather than, you know, maybe they've paid to come along, where people see coaching as a great way to manipulate people into doing what they want them to do. You know, if you don't have that openness to and that belief in people, then I don't think there's any point being a physio or a coach.
A bit of an alley I'm going to go down, but I don't know if you have you seen Jodie Comer's Prima Facie one woman show. Everybody, it's being live streamed from the National Theatre at the moment, and it's in that's obviously about, well, not obviously, it's about the legal system rather than the healthcare system, but it's exactly the same. It's she, as a single actress, she plays both a defense lawyer for sexual abuse cases and a victim, and the whole purpose of the show is to interrogate the sort of the notion that you can get so wedded to the beauty of the law, and it as a tool, and so in love with what it can do as a tool, that certainly in these particular types of trials, it's just exposing however clever and wonderful a tool it is, it often isn't nuanced enough to deal with human beings and fallibility and all the things that we encounter in the physio and in coaching. If anyone hasn't seen it, I would really, really recommend it. It's one of the best things I've seen in years. It's great. All right. Lisa, thank you so much. I'm conscious of time. We have got through all the questions I wanted to ask you, and your answers have been brilliant and definitely taken me a lot deeper than my original thoughts had gone. And the person who asked those questions is going to absolutely love this podcast. And I hope lots of other people will enjoy it as well. Is there anything else on that subject that you think we haven't covered that you want to say?
I think that both of these, I think that the other thing that physio and coaching has in common when it's at its best is that it's fun.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a lightness. We can all get so serious in life and healing journeys, and you know, but the lightness is so important to be able to take what we're doing seriously, but take ourselves lightly. You know, I think for me that allows all of these questions to have a much wider scope of possibility.
Yeah, lovely point. A little bit of lightness in your physio and in your coaching. Thank you. That's a great point to finish on. Lisa, you're always up to a million things. Are there any particularly that you'd like to tell people about that might be interested that you're offering or up to in the world at the moment?
So many things. Obviously, I do lots of coach training. My Instagram is, I just have a brand new Instagram account, which is going to have a lot more coaching tips on it. So, and sort of running lives and things. So that might be, you know, a nice way to come and connect. And if you've got any questions or anything, let me know.
Yeah, I'm going to have a look at that. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously one way to get hold of you. Is that the best way, or any other contact details you want to leave people with if they've been interested in anything you've had to say?
I think that's the place I sort of hang out most. You know, you can find me on Facebook, but then it's easy to get lost on Facebook, whereas that new account, I am Lisa Wynn, it's called, then I'll see messages there. And you'll get to hear when I have my own podcast, which is about to start season two, the Legacy Creation podcast. So Instagram's a great hub to find out whatever else I'm up to.
Instagram or the Legacy Creation podcast. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Lisa. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Good time. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation and that real sort of in-depth discussion around what coaching is and isn't, who it's appropriate for, who it might not be, who might be an ideal coach, what sort of things are prerequisites for both sides of that relationship, and some really lovely phrases to take away. The safe human, the reverence for emotion or pain. Loads and loads of phrases, which I'm going to log and recollect and reuse many times, I'm sure. If you were interested in anything Lisa or I had to say, at the end there, Lisa gave very clear instructions of how to get hold of her, either through her Instagram account or through her podcast, a Legacy Creation podcast. Equally, if you are interested in MeHab, then you can find out more information on the website, www.mehab.co.uk. There's lots of information about MeHab itself, its mission, its purpose, and if you have any interest in coaching, then there's some information about that and some links to book a call with me if you wish. And you can also get hold of me on LinkedIn and on Twitter, MeHab_Joe. As always, I would love to hear your feedback and your thoughts, any insights that you had independently of the ones that Lisa and I had during the conversation. Just get in touch, let me know via email, joe@mehab.co.uk. Lots of tags and addresses to remember there. Okay, I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of You Matter. If you are a busy clinician or a coach, looking after people in all areas of your life, all day, every day, then remember to stop and breathe, because you matter.